We're not sure. He fell near his office and was taken to the nearest hospital. He died there, was the reply.
He was not arrested? Not killed by the Jews?
No, there is no report of that.
So it was a natural death?
So it appears at this time.
I wonder if he did the funds transfer before he left this life, Mohammed thought.
I see.
He didn't, of course, but he had to fill the silence with some words.
So, there is no reason to suspect foul play?
Not at this time, no. But when one of our people dies, one always.
Yes, I know, Eamon. One always suspects. Does his father know?
That is how I found out.
His father will probably be glad to be rid of the wastrel, Mohammed thought. Who do we have to make sure of the cause of death?
Ahmed Mohammed Hamid Ali lives in London. Perhaps through a solicitor?
Good idea. See that it is done. A pause. Has anyone told the Emir?
No, I don't think so.
See to it.
It was a minor matter, but even so, he was supposed to know everything.
I shall, Eamon promised.
Very well. That is all, then. And Mohammed thumbed the kill button on his cell phone. He was back in Vienna. He liked the city. For one thing, they'd handled the Jews here once, and many Viennese managed to control their regrets over it. For another, it was a good place to be a man with money. Fine restaurants, staffed by people who knew the value of skilled service to their betters. The former imperial city had a lot of cultural history to appreciate when he was of a mind to be a tourist, which happened more often than one might imagine. Mohammed found that he often did his best thinking when looking at something of no importance to his work. Today, an art museum, perhaps. He'd let Eamon do the scut work for now. A London solicitor would root about for information surrounding Uda's death, and, being a good mercenary, he'd let them know of anything untoward. But sometimes people simply died. It was the hand of Allah, which was not something easily understood and never predicted. Or maybe not so dull. NSA cross-decked some new message traffic after lunch. Jack did some mental arithmetic and decided it was evening on the other side of the pond. The electronic weenies of the Italian Carabinieri, their federal police, who walked about in rather spiffy uniforms, had made some intercepts, which they'd forwarded to the U.S. Embassy in Rome, and which had gone right up on the satellite to Fort Belvoir, the main East Coast downlink. Somebody named Mohammed had called somebody named Eamon. They knew this from the recorded conversation, which had also mentioned the death of Uda bin Salih, which had caused an electronic bingo on various computers, flagging it for a signals intelligence analyst and causing the embassy puke to squirt the bird. Has anyone told the Emir? Who the hell is the Emir? Jack asked. That's a nobleman's title, like a duke or something, Wills answered. What's the context?
Here. Jack handed a printed sheet across.
That looks interesting.
Wills turned and queried his computer for Emir, and got only one reference.
According to this, it's a name or title that cropped up about a year ago in a tapped conversation, context uncertain, and nothing significant since. The agency thinks it's probably shorthand for a medium-sized hitter in their organization.
And this context looks bigger than that to me, Jack thought aloud.
Maybe, Tony conceded. There's a lot about these guys that we don't know yet.
Langley will probably write it off to somebody in a supervisory position. That's what I would do, he concluded, but not confidently.
We have anybody on staff who knows Arabic?
Two guys who speak the language, from the Monterey School, but no experts on the culture, no.
I think it's worth a look.
Then write it up, and we'll see what they think. Langley has a bunch of mind readers, and some of them are pretty good.
Mohammed is the most senior guy we know in this outfit. Here he's referring to somebody senior to himself. That is something we need to check out, the younger Ryan pronounced, with all the power he possessed.
For his part, Wills knew that his roomie was right. He'd also just implicitly identified the biggest problem in the intelligence business. Too much data, too little analytical time. The best play would be to fake an inquiry to CIA from NSA and to NSA from CIA, asking for some thoughts on this particular issue. But they had to be careful with that. Requests for data happened a million times a day, and due to the volume, they were never, ever checked. The comm link was secure, after all, wasn't it? But asking for time from analysts could too easily result in a telephone call, which required both a number and a person to pick up the phone. That could lead to a leak, and leaks were the single thing the campus could not afford. And so, inquiries of this kind went to the top floor, maybe twice a year. The campus was a parasite on the body of the intelligence community. Such creatures were not supposed to have a mouth for speaking, but only for sucking blood. "Write your ideas up for Rick Bell, and he'll discuss it with the senator," Wills advised. "Great," Jack grumbled. He hadn't learned patience yet. More to the point, he hadn't learned much about bureaucracies. Even the campus had one. The funny thing was that if he'd been a mid-level analyst at Langley, he could have picked up a phone, dialed a number, and talked to the right person for an expert opinion or something close to it. But this wasn't Langley. CIA was actually pretty good about obtaining and processing information. It was doing something effective with it that constantly befuddled the government agency. Jack wrote up his request and the reasons for it, wondering what would result. The emir took the news calmly. Uda had been a useful underling, but not an important one. He had many sources of money for his operations. He was tall for his ethnicity, not particularly handsome, with a Semitic nose and olive skin. His family was distinguished and very wealthy, though his brothers, he had nine, controlled most of the family money. His home in Riyadh was large and comfortable, but not a palace. Those he left to the royal family, whose numerous princelings paraded about as though each of them were the king of this land and protector of the holy places. The royal family, whose members he knew well, were objects of silent contempt for him. But his emotions were something buried within his soul. In his youth, he'd been more demonstrative. He'd come to Islam in his early teens, inspired by a very conservative imam whose preachings had eventually gotten him into trouble, but who had inspired a raft of followers and spiritual children. The emir was merely the cleverest of the lot. He, too, had spoken his mind, and as a result been sent off to England for his education, really to get him out of the country. But in England, in addition to learning the ways of the world, he'd been exposed to something entirely alien: freedom of speech and expression. In London, it is mostly celebrated at Hyde Park Corner, a tradition of spleen venting that dates back hundreds of years, sort of a safety valve for the British population, and which, like a safety valve, merely vents troublesome thoughts into the air without letting them take much hold anywhere. Had he gone to America, it would have been the radical press. But what had struck him as hard as the arrival of a spaceship from Mars was that people were able to challenge the government in any terms they pleased. He'd grown up in one of the world's last absolute monarchies, where the very soil of the nation belonged to the king, and the law was what the reigning monarch said it was, subject in name, if not in substance, to the Quran and the Sharia, the Islamic legal traditions, which dated back to the Prophet himself. These laws were fair, or at least consistent, but very stern indeed. The problem was that not everyone agreed about the words of the Quran, and therefore about how the Sharia applied to the physical world. Islam had no pope, no real philosophical hierarchy as other religions understood the concept, and therefore no cohesive standard of application to reality. The Shia and the Sunni were often, always at each other's throats over that question. And even within Sunni Islam, the Wahhabis, the principal sect of the kingdom, adhered to a stern belief system indeed. But for the emir, this very apparent weakness of Islam was its most useful attribute. One only had to convert a few individual Muslims to his particular belief system, which was remarkably easy, since you didn't have to go looking for those people. They identified themselves virtually to the point of advertising their identities. And most of them were people educated in Europe or America, where their foreign origin forced them to cleave together just to maintain a comfortable intellectual place of self-identity. And so they built upon a foundation of outsiderness that had led many of them to a revolutionary ethos. That was particularly useful, since along the way they'd acquired a knowledge of the enemy's culture that was vital in targeting his weaknesses. The religious conversions of these people had largely been pre-installed, as it were. After that, it was just a matter of identifying their objects of hatred. That is, the people to be blamed for their youthful discontent. And then deciding how to do away with their self-generated enemies, one at a time, or as a grand coup de main, which appealed to their sense of drama, if not their scant understanding of reality. And at the end of it, the emir, as his associates had taken to calling him, would be the new Mahdi, the ultimate arbiter of all of the global Islamic movement. The intra-religious disputes, Sunnis and Shia, for example, he planned to handle through a sweeping fatwa, or religious pronouncement of tolerance, that would look admirable even to his enemies. And after all, weren't there 100 or more Christian sects who had largely ended their own internal strife? He could even reserve to himself tolerance of the Jews, though he would have to save that for later years, after he had settled into the seat of ultimate power, probably with a palace of suitable humility outside the city of Mecca. Humility was a useful virtue for the head of a religious movement, for as the pagan Thucydides had proclaimed, even before the prophet, of all manifestations of power, that which most impresses men is restraint. It was the tallest of orders, the thing he wanted to accomplish. It would require time and patience, and its success was hardly guaranteed. It was his misfortune that he had to depend upon zealots, each of whom had a brain and the consequent strong opinions. Such people could conceivably turn on him and seek to replace him with religious outlooks of their own. They might even believe their own concepts. They might be true zealots, as the Prophet Muhammad had been. But Muhammad, blessings and peace be upon him, had been the most honorable of men, and had fought a good and honorable fight against pagan idolaters, while his own effort was mainly within the community of the faithful. Was he, then, an honorable man? A difficult question. But didn't Islam need to be brought into the current world and not remain trapped in antiquity? Did Allah desire his faithful to be prisoners of the 7th century? Certainly not. Islam had once been the center of human scholarship, a religion of advancement and learning that had, sadly, lost its way at the hands of the great Khan, and then been oppressed by the infidels of the West. The emir did believe in the Holy Quran and the teaching of the imams, but he was not blind to the world around him. Nor was he blind to the facts of human existence. Those who had power guarded it jealously, and religion had little to do with that, because power was a narcotic all its own. And people needed something, preferably someone, to follow if they were to advance. Freedom, as the Europeans and Americans understood the concept, was too chaotic. He'd learned that at Hyde Park Corner, too. There had to be order. He was the man to provide it. So, Uda bin Sali was dead, he thought, taking a sip of juice. A great misfortune for Uda, but a minor irritation to the organization. The organization had access to, if not a sea of money, then a number of comfortably large lakes, a small one of which Uda had managed. A glass of orange juice had fallen off the table, but thankfully it had not stained the carpet under it. It required no action on his part, even at second hand.
Ahmed, this is sad news, but not a matter of great importance to us. No action need be taken.
It shall be as you say, Ahmed Musa Marwali responded respectfully.
He killed his phone. It was a cloned phone, bought from a street thief for that one purpose, and then he tossed it into the river, Tevere, the Tiber, off the Ponte Sant'Angelo. It was a standard security measure for speaking with the great commander of the organization, whose identity was known to but a few, all of whom were among the most faithful of the believers. At the higher echelon, security was tight. They all studied various manuals for intelligence officers. The best had been bought from a former KGB officer, who had died after the sale, for so it had been written. Its rules were simple and clear, and they did not deviate from them a dot. Others had been careless, and they'd all paid for their foolishness. The former USSR had been a hated enemy, but its minions had never been fools, only unbelievers. America, the great Satan, had done the entire world a favor by destroying that abortion of a nation. They'd done it only for their own benefit, of course, but that, too, must have been written by the hand of God, because it had also served the interests of the faithful. For what man could plot better than Allah himself?
Chapter 19. Beer and Homicide. The flight into Munich was silky smooth. German customs were formal but efficient, and a Mercedes-Benz cab took them to the Hotel Bayerische. Their current subject was somebody named Anas Ali Atef, reportedly an Egyptian by nationality, and a civil engineer by education, if not by profession. 5 feet 9 inches or so, 145 pounds, clean-shaven. Black hair and dark brown eyes, supposed to be skilled at unarmed combat, and a good man with a gun, if he had one. He was thought to be a courier for the opposition, and he also worked to recruit talent, one of whom for certain had been shot dead in Des Moines, Iowa. They had an address and a photo on their laptops. He drove an Audi TT sports car, painted battleship gray. They even had the tag number. Problem. He was living with a German national named Trudel Heinz, and was supposedly in love with her. There was a photo of her, too. Not exactly a Victoria's Secret model, but not a skank, either. Brown hair and blue eyes, 5 feet 3 inches, 120 pounds. Cute smile. Too bad, Dominic thought, that she had questionable taste in men. But that was not his problem. Anas worshipped regularly at one of the few mosques in Munich, which was conveniently located a block from his apartment building. After checking in and changing their clothes, Dominic and Brian caught a cab to that location and found a very nice Gasthaus, a bar and grill, with outside tables from which to observe the area. Do all Europeans like to sit on the sidewalk and eat? Brian wondered. Probably easier than going to the zoo, Dominic said. The apartment house was 4 stories, proportioned like a cement block, painted white with a flat but strangely barn-like roof. There was a remarkably clean aspect to it, as though it was normal in Germany for everything to be as pristine as a Mayo Clinic operating room, but that was hardly cause for criticism. Even the cars here were not as dirty as they tended to be in America. "Was darf es sein?" the waiter asked, appearing at the table. "Zwei Dunkel Bieren, bitte," Dominic replied, using about a third of his remaining high school German. Most of the rest was about finding the Herrenzimmer, always a useful word to know in any language. "American, yes?" the waiter went on. "Is my accent that bad?" Dominic asked with a limp smile. "Your speech is not Bavarian, and your clothes look American," the waiter observed matter-of-factly, as though to say the sky was blue. "Okay, then 2 glasses of dark beer, if you please, sir."
2 Kombacher sofort,
the man responded and hurried back inside. "I think we just learned a little lesson, Enzo," Brian observed. "Buy some local clothes, first chance we get. Everybody's got eyes," Dominic agreed. "Hungry?"
I could eat something. We'll see if they have a menu in English. That must be the mosque our friend uses down the road a block, see? Brian pointed discreetly. So figure he'll probably walk this way? Seems likely, bro. And there's no clock on this, is there? They don't tell us how, they just tell us what, the man said, Brian reminded his brother. Good, Enzo observed as the beer arrived. The waiter looked to be about as efficient as a reasonable man could ask. Danke, sir. Do you have a menu in English? Certainly, sir. And he produced one from an apron pocket as though by magic. Very good. And thank you, sir. He must have gone to waiter university, Brian said as the man walked away again. But wait till you see Italy. Those guys are artists. That time I went to Florence, I thought the bastard was reading my mind. Probably had a doctorate in waitering. No inside parking at that building, probably around the back, Dominic said, coming back to business. No inside parking at that building, probably around the back, Dominic said, coming back to business. Is the Audi TT any good, Enzo? It's a German car. They make decent machines over here, man. The Audi isn't a Mercedes, but it ain't no Yugo, either. I don't know that I've ever seen one outside of Motor Trend, but I know what they look like, kind of curvy, slick, like it goes fast. Probably does, with the Autobahns they have here. Driving in Germany can be like running the Indy 500 or so, they say. I don't really see a German driving a slow car. Makes sense, Brian scanned the menu. The names of the dishes were in German, of course, but with English subtitles. It looked as though the commentary was for Brits rather than Americans. They still had NATO bases here. Maybe to guard against the French rather than the Russians, Dominic thought with a chuckle. Though historically, the Germans didn't need much help from that direction. What do you wish to have, mein Herrn? The waiter asked, reappearing as though transported down by Scotty himself. First, what is your name? Dominic asked. Emil. Ich heiße Emil. Thank you. I'll have the sauerbraten and potato salad. Then it was Brian's turn. And I'll have the bratwurst. Mind if I ask you a question? Of course, Emil responded. Is that a mosque down the street? Brian asked, pointing. Yes, it is. Isn't that unusual? Brian pushed the issue. We have many Turkish guest workers in Germany, and they are also Mohammedans. They will not eat the sauerbraten or drink the beer. They do not get on well with us Germans, but what can one do about it? The waiter shrugged, with only a hint of distaste. Thank you, Emil, Brian said, and Emil hurried back inside. What does that mean? Dominic wondered. They don't like him very much, but they don't know what to do about it, and they're a democracy just like we are, so they have to be polite to him. The average Fritz in the street isn't all that keen on their guest workers, but there's not much real trouble about it, just scuffles and like that. Mainly bar fights, so I'm told. So I guess the Turks have learned to drink the beer. How'd you learn that? Dominic was surprised. There's a German contingent in Afghanistan. We were neighbors. Our camps, like, and I talked with some of the officers there. Any good? They're Germans, bro. And this bunch was professionals, not draftees. Yeah, they're pretty good, Aldo assured him. It was a reconnaissance group. Their physical routine is tough as ours. They know mountains pretty good, and they are well-drilled at the fundamentals. The non-coms got along like thieves, swapped hats and badges a lot. They also brought beer along with their T-O-N-E, so they were kind of popular with my people. You know, this beer is pretty damn good. Like in England, beer is a kind of religion in Europe, and everybody goes to church. Then Emil appeared with lunch, Mittagessen, and that, they both learned, was also okay. But both kept watching the apartment house. This potato salad is dynamite, Aldo, Dominic observed between bites. I never had anything like it. Lots of vinegar and sugar, kind of crispy on the palate. Good food isn't all Italian. When we get home, gotta try to find a German restaurant. Roger that. Looky, looky, Enzo. It wasn't their subject, but
but it was his squeeze, Trudel Heinz. Just like the photo on their computers, walking out of the apartment house. Pretty enough to turn a man's head, briefly, but not a movie star. Her hair had been blonde once, but that had changed in her mid-teens by the look of her. Nice legs. Better than average figure. A pity she'd linked up with a terrorist. Maybe he'd latched onto her as part of his cover. And so much the better for him that it had side benefits. Unless they were living platonically, which didn't seem likely. Both Americans wondered how he treated her. But you couldn't tell something like that from watching her walk. She went up the other side of the street, but past the mosque. So, she wasn't heading there at the moment. I'm thinking, if he goes to church, we can poke him coming out. Lots of anonymous people around, you know? Brian thought aloud. Not a bad concept. We'll see how faithful this guy is this afternoon and what the crowd's like. Call that a definite maybe, Dominic replied. First, let's finish up here and then get some clothes that'll fit us in better. Roger that, Brian said. He checked the time, 1400. 8 in the morning at home. Only 1 hour of jet lag from London, easily written off. Jack came in earlier than usual, his interest piqued by what he took to be an ongoing operation in Europe, and wondering what today's message traffic would show. It turned out to be fairly routine, with some additional traffic on Solly's death. Sure enough, MI5 had reported his death to Langley as having been the apparent result of a heart attack, probably caused by the onset of fatal arrhythmia. That's what the official autopsy read, and his body had been released to a solicitor's firm representing the family. Arrangements were being made to fly him home to Saudi Arabia. His apartment had been looked at by the London version of a black bag team, which had not, however, turned up anything of particular interest. That included his office computer, whose hard drive had been copied and the data carted off. It was being examined bit by bit by their electronic weenies, details to follow. That could take a lot of time, Jack knew. Stuff hidden on a computer was technically discoverable, but theoretically you could also take the pyramids of Giza apart stone by stone to see what was hidden under them. If Solly had been really clever about burying things into slots only he knew about, or in a code to which he only knew the key, well, it would be tough. Had he been that clever? Probably not, Jack thought. But you could only tell by looking, and that was why people always looked. It'd take at least a week, to be sure. A month if the little bastard was good with keys and codes. But just finding hidden stuff would tell them that he'd been a real player and not just a stringer, and the varsity at GCHQ would be assigned to it. Though none of them would be able to discover what he'd taken away to death with him inside his head. Hey, Jack, Will said, coming in. Morning, Tony. Nice to be eager. What have they turned on our departed friend? Nothing much. They're airmailing the box home later today, probably, and the pathologist called it a heart attack. So our guys are clean. Islam pretty much requires that the body be disposed of quickly and in an unmarked grave. So once the body's gone, it's all the way gone. No exhumation to check for drugs and stuff. So, we did do it. What did we use? Ryan asked. Jack, I do not know and I do not want to know what, if anything, we had to do with his untimely death. Nor do I have any desire to find out, nor should you. Okay? Tony, how the hell can you be in this business and not be curious? Jack Jr. demanded. You learn what is not good to know, and you learn not to speculate on such things, Wills explained. Uh-huh, Jack reacted dubiously. Sure, but I'm too young for that shit, he didn't say. Tony was good at what he did, but he lived inside a box. So did Solly right now, Jack thought. And it wasn't a good place to be. And besides, we did waste his ass. Exactly how, we didn't know. He could have asked his mom about what drugs or chemicals there might be that could accomplish this mission, but no, he couldn't do that. She'd sure as hell tell his father. And Big Jack would sure as hell want to know why his son had asked such a question, and might even guess the answer, So, no, that was out of the question. All the way out. With the official government traffic on Sally's death, Jack started looking for NSA and related intercepts from other interested sources. There was no further reference to the Emir in the daily traffic. That had just come and gone, and previous references were limited to the one Tony had pulled up. Similarly, his request for a more global search of signals records at Fort Meade and Langley had not been approved by the people upstairs, disappointingly but not surprisingly. Even the campus had its limits. He understood the unwillingness of the people upstairs to risk having somebody wonder who'd made such a request and not finding an answer to make a deeper query. But there were thousands of such requests back and forth every day, and one more couldn't raise that much of a ruckus, could it? He decided not to ask, however. There was no sense in being identified as a boat rocker this early into his new career. But he did instruct his computer to scan all new traffic for the word Emir, and if it came up, he could log it, and then have a firmer case for his special inquiry the next time, if there was a next time. Still, a title like that, to his mind it was indicative of the ID for a specific person, even if the only reference CIA had about it was probably an in-house joke. The judgment had come from a senior Langley analyst, which carried a lot of weight in that community and therefore in this one as well. The campus was supposed to be the outfit that corrected CIA's mistakes and or inabilities. But since they had fewer people on staff, they had to accept a lot of ideas that came from the supposedly disabled agency. It did not make all that much logical sense, but he hadn't been consulted when Hendley had set the place up, and therefore he had to assume that the senior staff knew their business. But as Mike Brennan had told him about police work, assumption was the mother of all screw-ups. It was also a widely known adage of the FBI— Everybody made mistakes, and the size of any mistake was directly proportional to the seniority of the man making it. But such people didn't like to be reminded of that universal truth. Well, nobody really did. They bought the clothes off the rack. They were generally like what one would buy in America, but the differences, while individually subtle, added up to an entirely different look. They also got shoes to match the outfits, and after changing at their hotel, they went back out on the street. The passing grade came when Brian was stopped on the street by a German citizen asking directions to the Hauptbahnhof, at which time Brian had to respond in English that he was new here, and the German woman backed away with an embarrassed smile and buttonholed somebody else. "It means the main train station," Dominic explained. "So why can't you catch a cab?" Brian demanded. "We live in an imperfect world, Aldo. But now you must look like a good crowd. If anyone else asks you, just say, 'Ich bin ein Ausländer.' It means I'm a foreigner, and that'll get you out of it. Then they'll probably ask the question in better English than you'd hear in New York." "Hey, look!" Brian pointed to the golden arches of a McDonald's, a more welcome sight than the stars and stripes over the U.S. consulate. Though neither felt like eating there. The local food was simply too good. By nightfall, they were back at the Hotel Bayerische, enjoying just that. "Well, they're in Munich, and they spotted the subject's building and mosque, but not him yet," Granger reported to Hendley. "They eyeballed his lady friend, though." "Things going smoothly, then?" the senator asked. "No complaints to this point. Our friend is not being looked at by the German police. Their counterintelligence service knows who he is, but they're not running any sort of case on him. They've had some problems with domestic Muslims, and some of them are being covered, but this guy hasn't popped up on the radar screen yet. And Langley hasn't pressed the issue. Their relations with Germany aren't all that good at the moment." "Good news and bad news." "Right," Granger nodded. "They can't feed us much information, but we don't have to worry about fooling a tail. The Germans are funny. If you keep your nose clean and everything's in Ordnung, you're reasonably safe. If you step over the line, They can make your life pretty miserable. Historically, their cops are very good, but their spooks are not. The Soviets and the Stasi both had their spook shop thoroughly penetrated, and they're still living that down today.
They do black ops?
Not really. Their culture is too legalistic for that. They raise honest people who play by the rules, and that's a crippling influence on special operations. Those they do try occasionally crater badly. You know, I bet the average German citizen even pays his taxes on time and in full.
Their bankers know how to play the international game, Henley objected.
Yeah, well, maybe that's because international bankers don't really recognize the concept of having a country to be loyal to, Granger responded, sticking the needle in slightly.
Lenin once said, "The only country a capitalist knows is the ground he stands on when he makes a deal."
There are some like that, Henley allowed.
Oh, did you see this?
He handed over the request from downstairs to root around for somebody called the Emir. The director of operations scanned the page and handed it back. He doesn't make much of a case for it.
Henley nodded.
I know. That's why I denied it.
But you know, it caused his instincts to twitch. And he had the brains to ask a question.
And the boy's smart.
Yes, he is.
That's why I had Rick set him up with Wills as a roommate and training officer. Tony is bright, but he doesn't reach outside very much. So Jack can learn the business and also learn about its limitations. We'll see how much he chafes from that. If this kid stays with us, he just might go places.
You think he has his father's potential? Granger wondered.
Big Jack had been a king spook before going on to bigger things.
I think he might grow into it, yes. Anyway, this Emir business strikes me as a fundamentally good idea on his part. We don't know much about how the opposition operates. It's a Darwinian process out there, Sam. The bad guys learn from their antecedents, and they get smarter. On our nickel. They're not going to offer themselves up to get a smart bomb in the ass. They're not going to try to be TV stars. Good for the ego, maybe, but fatal. A herd of gazelles doesn't knowingly head toward the lion pride.
True, Granger agreed, thinking back to how his own ancestor had handled obstreperous Indians in the 9th U.S. Cavalry Regiment. Some things didn't change much.
Jerry, the problem is, all we can do about their organizational model is to speculate. And speculation is not knowledge.
So, tell me what you think, Henley ordered.
Minimum 2 layers between the head of it all. Is it one man or a committee? We do not and cannot know right now. And the shooters? We can get all those we want, but that's like cutting grass. You cut it, it grows. You cut it grows ad infinitum. You want to kill a snake? Best move is to take off the head.
Okay, fine, we all know that.
Trick is finding the head, because it's a virtual head. Whoever it is, or are, they're operating a lot like we are, Jerry. That's why we're doing a recon by fire, to see what we can shake loose. And we have all of our analytical troops looking for that, here and Langley and Meade.
A tired sigh.
Yes, Sam, I know. And maybe something will shake loose. But patience is a mother to live by. The opposition is probably basking in the sun right now, feeling good about stinging us, killing all those women and kids. Nobody likes that, Jerry. But even God took 7 days to make the world, remember?
You turning preacher on me? Henley asked with narrowed eyes.
Well, the eye for an eye part works for me, bud, but it takes time to find the eye. We have to be patient.
You know, when Big Jack and I talked about the need for a place like this, I was actually dumb enough to think we could solve problems more quickly if we had the authority to do so.
We'll be quicker than the government ever will, but we're not the man from Uncle.
Hey, look, the operational end just got underway. We've made only one hit. Three more to go before we can expect to see any real response from the other side.
Patience, Jerry.
Yeah, sure. He didn't add that time zones didn't help much either.
You know, there's one other thing.
What's that, Jack? Wills asked.
It would be better if we knew what operations were going on. It would enable us to focus our data hunt a little more efficiently.
It's called compartmentalization. No, it's called horseshit, Jack shot back. If we're on the team, we can help. Things that might look like non sequiturs appear different if you know the context that appears out of nowhere.
Tony, this whole building is supposed to be a compartment, right?
Subdividing it like they do at Langley doesn't help get the job done, or am I missing something?
I see your point, but that's not how the system works.
Okay, I knew you'd say that, but how the hell do we fix what's broke at CIA if all we do is just to clone their operation? Jack demanded.
And there wasn't a ready answer for that which would satisfy the questioner, was there? Wills asked himself. There simply wasn't, and this kid was catching on way too fast. What the hell had he learned in the White House?
For damn sure he'd asked a lot of questions, and he'd listened to all the answers, and even thought about them.
I hate to say this, Jack, but I'm only your training officer, not the big boss of this outfit.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that. I guess I got used to my dad having the ability to make things happen. Well, it looked that way to me, at least. Not to him, I know, not all the time.
Maybe impatience is a family characteristic.
Doubly so, since his mom was a surgeon, accustomed to fixing things on her own schedule, which was generally right the hell now.
It was hard to be decisive sitting at a workstation, a lesson his dad had probably had to learn in his time, back when America had lived in the gun sights of a really serious enemy. These terrorists could sting, but they couldn't do serious structural harm to America, though it had been tried in Denver once. These guys were like swarming insects rather than vampire bats.
But mosquitoes could transmit yellow fever, couldn't they?
South of Munich, in the port city of Piraeus, a container was lifted off its ship by a gantry crane and lowered to a waiting truck trailer. Once secured, the trailer went off, behind the Volvo truck driving out of the port, bypassing Athens and heading north into the mountains of Greece. The manifest said it was going to Vienna, a lengthy non-stop drive over decent highways, delivering a cargo of coffee from Colombia. It didn't occur to the port security people to conduct a search, since all the bills of lading were in good order and passed the barcode scans properly. Already men were assembling to deal with the part of the cargo not intended to be mixed with hot water and cream. It took a lot of men to break down a metric ton of cocaine into dose-sized packets. But they had a single-story warehouse recently acquired in which to accomplish the task. And then they would be driving individually all over Europe, taking comfort in the lack of internal borders the continent had adopted since the formation of the European Union. With this cargo, the word of a business partner was being kept, and a psychological profit was being recompensed by a monetary one. The process went on through the night. While Europeans slept the sleep of the just, even those who would soon be making use of the illegal part of the cargo as soon as they found a street dealer. They saw the subject at 9:30 the following morning. They were having a leisurely breakfast at another Gasthaus, half a block from the one that employed their friend Emil, and Anas Ali Atef was walking purposely up the street and came within 20 feet of the twins, who were breakfasting on strudel and coffee, along with 20 or so German citizens. Atef didn't notice he was being watched. His eyes looked forward and did not discreetly scan the area as a trained spook would have done. Evidently he felt safe here. And that was good.
"There's our boy," Brian said, spotting him first.
As with Sally, there was no neon sign over his head to mark him, but he matched the photo perfectly, and he had come out of the right apartment building. His mustache made an error in identification unlikely.
reasonably well-dressed. Except for his skin and mustache, he might have passed for a German. At the end of the block, he boarded a streetcar, destination unknown, but heading east. "Speculate?" Dominic asked his brother. "Off to have breakfast with a pal? Or to plot the downfall of the infidel West? We really can't say, man." "Yeah, it'd be nice to have real coverage on him. But we're not conducting an investigation, are we? This mutt recruited at least one shooter. He's earned his way onto our shit list, Aldo." "Roger that, bro," Brian agreed. His conversion was complete. Anas Ali Atef was just a face to him now, and an ass to be stuck with his magic pen. Beyond that, he was someone for God to talk to in due course, a jurisdiction that didn't directly concern either of them at the moment. If this was a bureau op, we'd have a team in the apartment right now, at least to toss his computer. Brian conceded the point. "Now what?" "We see if he goes to church. And if he does, we see how easy it might be to pop him on the way in or out." "Does it strike you that this is going a little fast?" Brian wondered aloud. "I suppose we could sit in the hotel room and jerk off, but that's hard on the wrist, you know?" "Yeah, I guess so." Finishing breakfast, they left cash on the table, but not a large tip. That would, too, surely mark them as Americans. The streetcar wasn't as comfortable as his car, but it was ultimately more convenient because of the necessity of finding a parking place. European cities had not been designed with automobiles in mind. Neither had Cairo, of course, and the traffic jams there could be incredible, even worse than they were here. But at least in Germany they had reliable mass transportation. The trains were glorious. The quality of the lines impressed the man who'd had engineering training a few. Was it really just a few, he asked himself? It seemed like a complete lifetime, years before. The Germans were a curious people. Standoffish and formal, and oh, so superior, they thought, to all other races. They looked down on Arabs, and indeed on most other Europeans as well, and opened their doors to foreigners only because their internal laws, imposed upon them 60 years earlier by Americans after World War II, said that they must. But because they were compelled to do so, they did, mostly without open complaint, because these mad people obeyed the law as though it had been delivered to them by God's own hand. They were the most docile people he'd ever encountered, but underneath that docility was the capacity for violence, organized violence, such as the world hardly knew. Within living memory, they'd risen up to slaughter the Jews. They'd even converted their death camps into museums, but museums in which the pieces and machines undoubtedly still worked, as though standing ready. What a pity they could not summon the political will to make it so. The Jews had humiliated his country 4 separate times, in the process killing his eldest brother Ibrahim in the Sinai when he'd been driving a Soviet T-62 tank. He didn't remember Ibrahim. He'd been far too young then, and only had photographs to give him an idea of what he'd looked like, though his mother still wept for his memory. He'd died trying to finish the job these Germans had started, only to fail. Killed by a cannon shot from an American M60A1 main battle tank at the Battle of the Chinese Farm. It was the Americans who protected the Jews. America was ruled by its Jews. That was why they supplied his enemies with weapons, fed them with intelligence information, and loved killing Arabs. But the Germans' failure at their task hadn't tamed their arrogance, just redirected it. He could see it on the streetcar, the brief sideways looks, the way old women scuttled a few steps away from where he stood. Someone would probably wipe down the overhead bar with disinfectant after he got off, Anas grumbled to himself. By the prophet, these were unpleasant people. The ride took another 7 minutes exactly, and it was time to get off at Domstrasse. From there, it was a 1-block walk. Along the way, he saw more of the glances, the hostility in the eyes, or even worse, the eyes that took note of his presence and just passed on, as though having seen a stray dog. It would have been satisfying to take some action here in Germany, right here in Munich. But his orders were specific. His destination was a coffee shop. Fa'ad Rahman Yassin was already there, dressed casually like a working man. There were many like him in this cafe. "Salam alaikum," Atef said in greeting. "Peace be unto you."
"Alaikum salam,"
Fa'ad said in return. "The pastry here is excellent." "Yes," Atef agreed, speaking softly in Arabic. "So, what is new, my friend?"
"Our people are pleased with last week. We have shaken the Americans badly," Fa'ad said.
"Not enough for them to disown the Israelis. They love the Jews more than their own children. Mark my words on this. And they will lash out at us."
"How?"
Fa'ad demanded.
"Lash out, yes. At whomever their spy agencies know about. But that will only inflame the faithful and drive more to our cause. No, our organization they do not know about. They do not even know our name."
This was because their organization did not really have a name.
Organization was merely a descriptive word for their association of the faithful.
"I hope you are correct. So, do I have more orders?"
"You have done well. Three of the men you recruited chose martyrdom in America."
"Three?" Atef was agreeably surprised. "They died well, I trust."
"They died in Allah's holy name. That should be good enough.
So, do you have any more recruits ready for us?"
Atef sipped his coffee.
"Not quite, but I have two leaning in our direction. This is not easy, as you know. Even the most faithful wish to enjoy the fruits of a good life, as he was doing himself, of course.
You have done well for us, Anas. Better to be sure than to be overly demanding of them. Take your time. We can be patient."
"How patient?" Atef wanted to know.
"We have additional plans for America, to sting them worse. This time we killed hundreds. The next time we shall kill thousands," Fa'ad promised, with a sparkle in his eye.
"How, exactly?" Atef asked immediately.
He could have been, should have been, a plans officer. His engineering education made him ideal for such things. Didn't they know that?
There were people in the organization who thought with their balls instead of their brains.
"That I am not at liberty to say, my friend."
Because he didn't know, Fa'ad Rahman Yassin did not say. He wasn't sufficiently trusted by those higher in the organization, which would have outraged him had he known it. "The son of a whore probably doesn't know himself," Atef thought at the same time. "We approach the hour of prayer, my friend," Anas Ali Atef said, checking his watch. "Come with me. My mosque is only 10 minutes away. It would soon be time for the salat." It was a test for his colleague, to make sure that he was truly faithful.
"As you say."
Both rose and walked to the streetcar, which 15 minutes later stopped a block from the mosque. "Heads up, Aldo," Dominic said. They'd been checking out the neighborhood really just to get a feel for the area, but there was their friend, walking down the street with what had to be a friend of his own.
"Who's WOG number 2, I wonder?" Brian said.
"Nobody we know, and we can't freelance."
"You packin'?" Dominic asked.
"Bet your bippy, bro."
"You?"
"Hang a big Roger on that," Dominic answered. Their target was about 30 yards off, walking right at them, probably heading to the mosque, which was half a block behind them. "What do you think?"
"Wave off. Better to bag him on the way out."
"Okay." And both turned right to look into the window of a hat shop. They heard, they damn near felt him pass by.
"How long do you suppose it'll take?"
"Damned if I know, man. I haven't been to church myself in a couple of months."
"Super," Brian growled. "My own brother's an apostate."
Dominic stifled a laugh. "You always were the altar boy in the family. Sure enough, Atef and his friend walked in. It was time for daily prayers, the Salat, the second of Islam's five pillars. They would bend and kneel, facing Mecca, whispering favored phrases from the Holy Quran, affirming their faith as they did so. On entering the building, they removed their shoes. And to Yasin's surprise, this mosque suffered from a German influence. There were individualized cubbyholes in the wall of the atrium for their shoes, all of them properly numbered to prevent confusion or theft. That was a rare offense indeed in any Muslim country, because the Islamic penalty for thievery was very harsh, and to do so in Allah's own house would have been a deliberate offense to God himself. Then they entered the mosque proper and made their obeisance to Allah. It didn't take long, and with it came a kind of refreshment for Atef's soul as he reaffirmed his religious beliefs. Then it was over. He and his friend made their way back to the atrium, collected their shoes, and walked outside. They weren't the first out of the large doors, and the others had served to alert the two Americans. It was really a question of which way they'd go. Dominic was watching the street, looking for a police or intelligence officer, but didn't see any. He was betting that their subject would head toward his apartment. Brian took the other direction. It looked as though 40 or so people had gone in for prayers. Coming out, they scattered to the four winds, singly or in small groups. Two got into the fronts of taxicabs, presumably their own, and drove off to catch fares. That did not include any of their co-religionists, who were probably working-class schlubs who walked or took public transportation. It hardly made them seem villainous to the twins, both of whom closed in, but neither too fast nor too obviously. Then the subject and his pal came out. They turned left, directly toward Dominic, 30 yards away. From his perspective, Brian saw it all. Dominic removed the gold pen from the inside pocket of his not-quite-a-suit jacket, furtively twisting the tip to arm it, then holding it in his right hand like an ice pick. He was heading on a close reciprocal course to the subject. It was, perversely, a thing of beauty to watch. Just 6 feet away, Dominic appeared to trip over something and fell right into the Atef guy. Brian didn't even see the stick. Atef went down with his brother, and that would have covered the discomfort of the stab. Atef's pal helped both of them up. Dominic made his apology and headed on his way, with Brian following the target. He hadn't seen Sally check out, and so this was interesting in a grim sort of way. The subject walked about 50 feet, then stopped in his tracks. He must have said something, because his friend turned as though to ask a question, just in time to see Atef fall down. One arm came up to protect his face from the fall, but then the entire body went limp. The second man was clearly dumbfounded by what he saw. He bent down to see what was wrong, first in puzzlement, then in concern, and then in panic, rolling the body over and speaking loudly to his fallen friend. Brian passed them about then. Atef's face was as composed and unmoving as a doll's. The guy's brain was active, but he couldn't even open his eyes. Brian stood there for a minute, then wandered off without looking back. But he gestured to a German passerby to provide assistance, which the German did, reaching into his coat and pulling out a cell phone. He'd probably call for an ambulance. Brian walked to the next intersection and turned to observe, checking his watch. The ambulance was there in 6.5 minutes. The Germans really were well organized. The responding fireman paramedic checked the pulse, looked up in surprise, and then with alarm. His co-worker on command pulled a box from inside the vehicle, and as Brian watched, Atef was intubated and bagged. The two firemen were well-trained, clearly going through a process they'd practiced in the station and had probably used on the street many times. In their urgency, they did not move Atef into the ambulance, but instead treated him as best they could on the spot. 10 minutes since he'd gone down, Brian saw by his watch. Atef was already brain-dead, and that was the name of that tune. The Marine officer turned left and walked to the next corner where he caught a taxi, fumbling through the name of the hotel, but the driver figured it out. Dominic was in the lobby when he got there. Together they headed for the bar. The one good thing about wasting a guy right out of church was that they could be reasonable.